Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, guys. You know, it's that special day. It's a special day for a lot of reasons. It's a beautiful day. It is probably the last day, or the last 2 days. You'll see it again tomorrow, where we're going to see temperatures in the 40s for a long, long time. You can say goodbye to the 40s. You know, as Taxman always reminds us, the Easter Sunday is always, on or about Easter Sunday, is always that last little outbreak, and it's interesting. It's pretty consistent. That last little outbreak of cold weather, cool weather. Those temperatures are going to be pretty beneficial to your garden. We're going to talk about them. We're going to talk about why that last little outbreak of cool weather is kind of nice for your garden, why it's going to make a lot of things work. I've been reading about it. I've been even your tomatoes. Just because of that little flash, that last little flash of cool weather, they're going to be the better for it. We're going to talk about why. We're going to talk about tomatoes and temperatures. We're going to talk about your other vegetables and temperatures. You know, if you planted carrots, if you've got, this is going to be your sugar snaps. This is going to be that last little cold spell they're going to really benefit from. And another thing that's going to happen this week kind of marks today. Today is the day that I would mark it. You can mark your calendar. This is the end of spring. It really is. You know, we like to say that there are six seasons here on the Gulf Coast. And we had a nice long spring. I thought it was a very nice spring, a very pleasant spring all in all. It was drier than usual. Things actually, which was good and bad. But for the most part, I think things did better. Things did better through this slightly drier spring. We hope it doesn't stay dry for our next season, which is coming up. But you know, here's the signal. Always happens about April 20th. Spring starts about February 20th, runs to February 15th, February 20th, runs to about April 15th, April 20th. And I'm gonna declare that for us on the Gulf Coast this year, April 20th was the end of spring, this last cold day, because next week, it happens, those days in the 80s. You know, there's going to be 3 or 4 days when we get temperatures in the 80s next week. And the next week, there's going to be temperatures in the 80s. Let me tell you, temperatures in the 80s are not compatible with the concept of spring. It signals something different is happening. It's going to be very pleasant those days in the 80s. The night temperatures are still going to be fairly low. In fact, we're going to see a lot of night temperatures in the 50s. Rarely will they get out of the 50s, but we'll have those daytime temperatures in the 80s. It is like the coming of summer in Michigan. It's like the coming of summer in Missouri. It's like, as we say, it is American summer. It's the kind of summer most people in America experience. This summer coming up, we're going to call it American summer. It's going to start here today, and it's going to continue to about the middle part of June. It's going to be perfect weather for your tomatoes. Everything is going to be great. For tomatoes, for a lot of things that you read about, your purple coneflowers are going to be in full bloom. Your daylilies are going to bloom. They're all going to be happy in this American summer. And then there'll be another summer, which signals happiness for another suite of plants. And we'll talk about that when it happens. But you can count the time now. We're now in American summer. We should talk about that. We should talk about what that means to your tomatoes. But I am thinking, for a lot of reasons, about gardens now and about what makes gardens work, and I'm creating a garden. And people are seeing me create a garden, and I'm thinking, oh, gosh, I got to be careful, because somebody's going to say, oh, boy, I'm going to loan that guy a tiller. And I have to be very careful, because People don't understand how tillers destroy gardens. I'm thinking about that. So I'm politely thinking of ways now to turn down tillers so that I don't have to destroy my garden with it. If you want to know how a tiller destroys a garden, you call me. We'll talk about it. But I'm also thinking about the soil and what makes good soil. And my dad, and people are always asking me, what makes good soil? How do you make good soil? And I'm trying to sort of boil it down, because you want soil to be alive. You want soil to be living. You want soil to sort of give everything. It's not just the soil particles that make your garden grow. We think, you know, because we're into hydroponics and all this crazy stuff now, we think that gardens are just made of little pieces of dirt that are sort of fit together somehow and roots grow in it. But here's the thing. Your soil has to live. I am serious. This isn't a metaphor. I'm talking about literally, it has to be full of creatures that you can't identify, you can't name, but they have to be really vibrant. Inevitably, your soil is going to have creatures in it. And inevitably, if you forget about how important those creatures are to the soil, how important those, all those things, not just the earthworms, but everything else in the soil, everything that lives in the soil, literally tens of thousands of different types of creatures in that soil. I know you don't believe that, but it's true. It's what makes soil work. And if you don't pay attention to that, what you end up with are the creatures in your soil that will eat your plants alive, because that's all you've allowed. Is the living plants and the creatures that prey on those living plants. But there are lots of other creatures in the soil. They're very important. They're what make topsoil black. Without those creatures in the soil, topsoil wouldn't be black. We wouldn't have topsoil. It's the creatures that make the topsoil. It's not the fertilizer. It's not the lime. It's the creatures that make it. Your soil has to be living. The creatures have to be living. And I think, how do you make creatures live in this soil? And I keep thinking about this over and over, and I want a simple way to describe to you how to make your soil live so that your plants can grow and so that your soil grows. Literally, your topsoil grows. It's an amazing thing. Your topsoil grows, and as your topsoil grows, your plants grow better. That's what you're looking for. How do you get there? And on a day like today, I think, you know, what you need to realize is that the way to make your soil live is to put as many dead things in it as you can. I know that sounds crazy. That's how it works. Isn't that amazing? The leaves, the trunks of trees, the carcasses of beetles, the poop of bacteria and nematodes and all of these other things, all of these things that we think of as dead, they are what make the soil live. Now, isn't that some kind of weird thing? That's the way it's been happening forever. The incorporation of things that seem dead, that seem lost, that seem like not important anymore, they're the things that make the soil live, because all of those creatures in the soil, all of those creatures in the soil feed on all that dead material. There's these old prairies of Alabama, and everybody's always got some crazy solution for fixing the Black Belt prairies, which we farmed out in, oh, probably 15 or 20 years, because we exhausted tens of thousands of years of dead material and wasted it so the soil community couldn't survive at all. And they say, what do we do to this soil? What does this soil need? It must need fertilizer. No. It must need lime. No. What it needs is an accumulation of dead things that the living survive and grow on. It's an amazing thing that happens. We'll talk more about that. How to make it work in your garden. We'll be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
On your bended knee, thank God, I dig no more taters. I decline I ain't gonna pick no peas. Because everything is on the phone, you know you got to go. I get down on your bended knee.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Look at this day. Look at this beautiful day. You know, it is the start of summer here along the Gulf Coast. A great time for us to be out in the yards getting things done. You know, I hope you've got your tomatoes planted before now. If you don't have, that's just a word of advice. A word of advice. Because spring is over, folks. And that's okay. It was a beautiful spring. It was a great spring. Spring is the time when it's best to start your tomatoes. If you start them now in American summer, it's like they're going to be ripening in the middle of Gulf summer, which is in July. And let me tell you, there's some problems there. We're going to tell you why in just a minute. If you have tomatoes and you haven't planted them, my recommendation is, or if you're inclined to plant tomatoes and you haven't planted them, my recommendation is wait until late June and plant them then. And here's why. And I've been reading a lot about this, so this is good to know. If you're interested in tomatoes, it's good to know. There have been a lot of experiments looking at fruit set in tomatoes. What makes tomatoes set fruit? What relationship does temperature have to that? There's a lot of really interesting information. One of the most interesting pieces of information is that fruit set, the setting of fruit, and the size of fruit is highest when the temperature is 65 degrees. Now think about that. Right about 65 degrees. Scientists talk in Celsius, but I think I got about the right translation there. It's about 65 degrees. Fruit set was poorest when the temperature was 50. In fact, there was zero fruit set when the temperature was 50 constantly. And zero fruit set when the temperature, almost zero fruit set when the temperature was 75. Wow. Think about that. Now, here's the other interesting thing, because this is important too, and this is something to think about. It's why these cool temperatures were good. We had a cool spell. Now, if your tomato is about initiating flower development, the flower development is best. Flower development was best. It was at its peak. The number of flowers that were produced on the tomato were at their peak when the temperature was at 50 degrees. Now, isn't that something? Not fruit set, because it was zero fruit set, but you got lots of flowers that the tomato set at about 50 degrees. Think about that. That's why I'll tell people, if your tomatoes are too protected early in the year, I mean, you don't want to, they need some protection. But if you coddle them too much, if you keep your little teepees and other things to protect them too much this time of year, they don't set flowers very well. You want those last little cold spells, because it sort of says to the plants, ooh, you better get on it. You better get on it. Life ain't perfect. Life ain't perfect. Things happen. Things catch up with you. Don't just put on new leaves. Don't just grow. With this cold spell, you got to know that things ain't perfect. You better start setting fruit so that you will have progeny, so that you'll have children that'll sort of carry on the tradition. That's what tomatoes do. And that's what those little cold spells, I think, basically initiate a lot of flower production. However, did you hear me? The fruits don't develop well unless the temperature is right at 65 degrees on average. Now, here's the great thing about American summer. Listen to me. Here's the great thing about American summer and tomatoes. American summer is that period of time when we get when the average temperature is swinging between 55 and 80 degrees pretty frequently. And that means it hits that 65 to 70 degree peak temperature for tomato production a lot. Tomatoes love those temperatures. Every night, even if the day is hot, which is nice, hot days can be very beneficial, warm days can be, the nights are perfect for tomato respiration and for tomato, for development of those tomato fruits, and for the development of large fruits, and the development of multiple fruits from the flowers. So this is the season. We got the little bit of kickstart here. We got the little bit of reminder. Hey, bud. Hey, tomato. You better get down to business here. And now, we're going to have these days that the temperature is perfect for forming large tomatoes and for perfect tomato set. That's it. This is why this is the great season of tomato. American summer is the season of tomatoes. If you don't get your tomatoes ready to go during American summer, folks, it ain't going to happen. Because here's what happens on June 20th. This is not a bad thing. It's just bad for your tomatoes. It's not a bad thing. On June 20th, about 2 months from now, well, that is 2 months from now, okay? June 20th, exactly 2 months from now, what's going to happen? It's American summer is going to be over, and you're going to know it because it's going to start raining every day. And because the night temperatures, they're not going to drop below 75. They're not going to drop below 75 degrees, rarely. I mean, even just for minutes, you may go weeks without the temperature dropping below 75 here on the coast. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean for your tomatoes? Well, I told you what it meant. Fruit set on tomatoes is very poor at that temperature. There are a lot of reasons for it. We're still trying to figure it out. It has to do with respiration of tomatoes. The germination occurs. It's a problem because you're not going to get fruit set because the tomatoes don't tolerate temperatures like that. Very few do, except for the very small tomatoes. So you're going to go for July and August and into much of September with temperatures rarely dropping below 75 degrees. And when that occurs, there ain't no tomatoes, folks. And besides, even if there are, the stink bugs, everything else are going to be such a problem. Now, there's an exception to this, and that's the small tomatoes. We'll talk about them in a minute. But if you're talking about large tomatoes, moderately large tomatoes, that's what happens. So that's why we try to get those tomatoes in early. And that's why I'm telling you, you know, wait on your tomato. If you haven't planted your tomato already, just wait until June, because you know what happens in June? Those tomatoes grow through July and August and early September. And then in late September, the temperatures drop again at night to a level that tomatoes love in order to set good fruit. You see how it works? It's that 65 to 70 degree window that we're looking for. Maybe give it 72. But somewhere between 64 and 72 degrees is the magic window for great tomatoes. And that's what we want to take advantage of. When we get those temperatures at night, it's perfect for tomato set and for tomato development. And that's what we're looking for. That's why we try to time our tomatoes along the Gulf Coast to get the best we can out of them. There's that story. You know, there's another interesting thing I've found out in thinking about tomatoes. If you don't mind me talking about tomatoes here for just a minute. It's kind of fun. Another thing to think about is that when they were doing these experiments, they were finding that, certain tomato varieties didn't seem to set fruit that well. They just weren't setting fruit that well. And what was the deal? What, even though the temperatures were right, everything was right, and these tomatoes were supposed to be particularly productive at setting fruit, they weren't setting fruit. And what was the problem? They were in a greenhouse in carefully controlled conditions, but what was wrong? And they went around and they started thumping the tomatoes, literally thumping the tomato flowers. Boom, tapping them with your fingers, they called it. I call it thumping tomatoes. The other reason your tomatoes need to be exposed to the winds, and the winds are very beneficial this time of year, and the other reasons tomatoes are productive is because there is a lot of wind this time of year, is that wind vibrates those flowers and causes them to set fruit. Mostly the wind takes care of that. Mostly the wind takes care of that this time of year. Bumblebees, they aren't actually carrying pollen from one tomato to another. They don't, you know, tomatoes don't really need pollen from another tomato to set fruit. We could talk about that later if you want to. What the bumblebees do is vibrate the flower. Boom. Hey, we're going to be back, talk a little bit more about your garden and tomatoes.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's that Gulf Coast Sunday morning when, boy, it just seems like what a great day. When there's just not a lot to complain about, is there? It's a beautiful, beautiful day out there. Getting lots of texts, getting some callers. We'll be talking about them here in just a minute. You know, Dan stays after me. Dan's persistent. Dan wants to know a little bit more about this soil thing. You know, what is it that we're what are the when I tell you, and I'm trying to tell you in the most pleasant sort of way. I'm trying to tell you in the most jovial sort of way that what your soil needs is dead things. And we don't like talking about that, but that's what it needs. It's an amazing thing. It needs dead things in order to live, and that's the way it's been working for a long time, folks. I didn't set it in motion. I'm just telling you how it happens. It's an interesting thing. But it needs this incorporation of material, like leaves that have fallen off of trees, and beetle carcasses, and pine bark. And we talk a lot about pine bark because it's a convenient method for people who aren't really prepared to use anything else. You know, leaf mold is one of the best things you can use. It's what forests have been using forever. And so as a consequence, plants are really well adapted. I mean, so why would plants like to grow in leaf mold? Well, because that's where plants have been growing for 400 million years. They create their own environment. Don't you see? See how it kind of works? It kind of is a nice circular little thing. Amazingly enough, plants create their own environment. They grow better the more dead material they produce and leave in one place. So leaves are great. Leaves are great. Pieces, dead wood is great. As it rots down, it's perfect. And, you know, one of the things I stress is don't feel like you need to dig it in. Because if you think about it, that's not what is happening in forest. The creatures are digging it in. They're pulling it down. You don't do a very good job of that, let me tell you. You do a terrible job of properly incorporating that dead material into the soil. Tillers are the worst way to get it in. But even a fork, a shovel, none of that works really well to stir that in the way the creatures do. They bring it in just the right way at just the right time. That's what you need to think about. Pine bark is convenient. And we recommend pine bark because there's a lot of it. That's large. Cedar mulch is designed to be resistant to breaking down. So eventually it breaks down, but it's pretty slow. So we don't recommend cedar mulch for your garden if you want to create good topsoil, because it can be rather slow to break down. Now, it'll break down eventually. And there's probably some chemicals in it that are going to probably not going to be good for your seedlings in the process. But when it breaks down, it'll be just fine. It's all fine when it breaks down. It all works. But practically speaking, we talk about pine bark because we know it breaks down not too fast, but at just the right rate. And we also know that plants can penetrate and get their roots into pine bark. Literally put their roots into the pine bark. It's an amazing thing how that happens. And so it's they actually can use the pine bark itself as a living stratum to live in. And so it's really good. Cedar mulch, not so much. But pine bark's good. It's really good. Oak would be good too if you could find it in quantities, and the bark could be broken down. It'd probably be just as good, but there's lots of pine bark out there. That's why we talk so much about pine bark. Hey, David, we're going to talk a little bit, too, about your milkweeds when we come back. But Tara is on the phone with some questions about tomatoes. Tara, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, thank you for getting to me before you move on from tomatoes, because I got a report on and the 1st of January, I got a tomato plant as a gift. And you know, as soon as you decide that you're never going to do something like Little Charlie Nightcap song, "I'll never do that no more," it jumps on you, doesn't it? So I just never grow tomatoes again. No relation to Charlie Moss, by the way, right?
Right.
Anyway,
thanks, Tara.
I got the plant. It had a tag that said celebrity. It produced three fruits over the winter. The first was Satsuma size, the second was intermediate, and the third was maybe golf ball size. They were like the winter grocery store tomatoes. They were pink. I don't know whether they're supposed, I've never grown these before, so I don't know if they were supposed to be red or not. Whatever. The first plant that I had, because I took the smallest tomato, they didn't even appear to ripen, of course, because it was the middle of winter, right, for us, literally our winter. And I took the smallest one, and just it had softened. It went from hard stage to softening. So I just took the thing and put it in a pot that I had that needed to have, it looked lonely, and I just, you know, crushed it in there and put some mulch over it. Now I have a seedling that's 14 inches, and then I have a big plant from the original plant. My question is, should I transplant the seedling now or wait until June to do that? And my other question is, with the blooms, the vibrating blooms, because I was wondering about my peppers doing the same thing on the inside, setting fruit. And I was going, wait a minute, there's no bugs in here and it's cold anyway, because this is a cool room. But vibrating the pepper blooms, does that also work the same as what you were talking about with the tomato blooms?
Well, I don't know.
Well, it does with
habanero. There it is. Yeah, so, you know, let me make something up here for a minute. I don't know. It's a good question. It's certainly a good question. We know that pollen transfer is a big problem for tomatoes. I don't know that it's as, even though tomatoes and peppers are in a funny way related. I don't know that we really know as much about that. About how tomatoes work. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, which one? The transplanting, or wait till June, or the vibrating pepper blooms?
Well, rephrase that question in a slightly different way.
I have two plants. One is bigger. It's not in as big a pot had I known that it would get this far along.
I'm
just giving that as the report kind of a thing. I don't know what it's going to do. I'll just keep watching it. But the smaller plant, should I go ahead and transplant it because it's in a far too small pot? Or wait till June when the temperatures...
That's a different question, isn't it? I would go ahead and transfer it to a larger pot. You really can't. The idea of planting in June, let me just be clear about the idea of planting in June, is that you start with a young plant that's not going to be vulnerable to diseases. Well, this one is now, but it won't be by June. You see what I'm saying? So you can't artificially, you can't keep a tomato from getting older other than to start a new tomato from seed. Does that make sense?
Well, if it didn't, then I would be using that on myself, right?
That's right. You got it. There it is. So it's going to get older. It's going to become more susceptible to diseases. If you tried to dwarf it, which is a funky way of trying to pretend that it's not getting older, it is getting older. It's just being dwarfed. You're going to make it even more susceptible to diseases and insects, which means that it's really going to be vulnerable when June comes along. So, yeah, you want to start a new tomato. And the way to do that, Tara, get some seeds.
I don't want to grow tomatoes. I've got this seedling, and it's so adorable, and it just came up on its own. I can't.
Then you're going to let it do what it does, because you're this is not about growing tomatoes, as you say, so you don't worry about it. You're just worried about keeping this thing alive.
Or should I use that little bit of real estate for something else?
Use the real estate for something else.
Okay. Thank you so much, and happy holiday to you, sir.
You too. All right. All right. There it is. So we had several answers. I just wasn't quite sure what the question was. And one of those answers may have fit. I hope it did, Tara. There it is. So this pine bark thing, you know, pine bark is a convenience. Let me tell you something. Let's refine our pine bark discussion just a little bit, since folks are asking. I don't really feel obliged to use pine bark in the vegetable garden. I prefer not to. I have done it, and it works okay. It works just fine. Leaf mold is so much better in the vegetable garden. It is a lot better. You need to add it more frequently, and pine bark has some benefits if you're just getting started. If you got to do something fast, pine bark has some benefits. If you're growing things in containers, pine bark is the best medium. Now, Taxman and I talk about this a little bit. I actually think it may help to mix the pine bark with leaf mold, which I think Taxman does that, and I think that's okay. That's good. Not too much leaf mold, maybe, you know, and it, it, we all experiment, but I would say probably 1/5 leaf mold to 4/5 pine bark would be good, with a little bit of maybe some other things in there too. But pine bark is not, you know, pine bark is just to help you out if you're in an immediate bind. It's very good for shrubs. It's really good for azaleas. And my good friend Martin Vandergeesen and I argue about this a lot, and we'll talk about what we argue about where incorporating pine bark is concerned here in just a minute when we come back from this break.
Me and my best friend Lillian and her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town. Me and Lillian, just across the line in a little southeast of Meridian. She loved her brother. I remember back when he was fixing up a 49 and in. He told her little sister gonna ride the wind up around the moon and back again. He never got farther than Vietnam. I was standing there with her when the telegram come. Oh, Lily, now he's lying somewhere about a million miles from Meridian.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yes, yes, yes. Welcome back. So we've been thinking about this thing called soil and what makes it work. Containers are a different sort of thing, aren't they? Because it's hard to create in containers that living environment that I'm talking about in the soil. A lot of people move to containers for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons they move to containers is because they never had living soil in the first place. If you have living soil and you have sunlight, two important things, you should be growing in the ground. It's a lot easier with living soil and sunlight. It beats everything else. It's great. It's perfect. But some folks, because they don't have enough sun in the right places and because they don't have living soil, they grow in containers. And containers are a very different sort of thing, aren't they? Because all of these soil creatures that I'm talking about, they don't exist in containers. They don't exist in containers because, well, they just don't have access to it. And so you have to create an artificial environment. That's why we say don't use regular soil in a container, because the living elements of that soil don't come with it very well. The drainage in those in regular soil can really compact it, and you get really compacted soil. It's a problem. So we create an artificial mix for plants growing in containers. And pine bark is the basis for that. It is the most important ingredient in a container mix. And there it is. If you look at growers here along the Gulf Coast, they are growing at least, almost all of them, at least 70% of their soil mix for containers is pine bark. 70% of it. Many, it's nearly 90 or nearly 100%. They will add other things to it that are a matter of, you know, it has a lot to do with what they can access. And what's convenient for them and what's a habit. You know, peat moss is both convenient and a habit. And so people use it. I think it works okay. I think probably leaf mold works better mixed in as that extra 15 to 30%. And so there it is. That's what, when you're doing in containers, it's very different. You also don't have things breaking down nutrients. So you have to fertilize a container more often, because the living processes of soil aren't going on and the nutrients aren't available unless you add them. Does that make sense? We've talked about, and one of the things that you need to add is a little bit of lime and calcium, because otherwise it would be deficient in this container mix. And you can do that with regular lime. I often used oyster shells. Oyster shells are crushed oyster shells. Now, these are not big oyster shells. These are crushed oyster shells, Dan. Crushed into small pieces. I actually use the stuff that they use for chicken feed, because chickens need extra calcium, and often they would get it from eating this oyster shell. And you can use that. You can use that in a mix. I use it less often because I'm a little worried. We need oysters to go back where oysters came from, which is in the bay and in the Gulf. We need to be doing more and more of that. Oysters have a huge impact on the quality of Mobile Bay that we don't think about. We only think oysters are good for eating, but they have a huge impact on the quality of the bay. We should talk about that sometime. But I have used oyster shells. Roses like a higher pH soil with calcium, and that's why we often used to recommend oyster shells for roses. I don't know that there's enough oyster shells to go around, so I'd be a little bit careful about that. But there it is too. There's the thing to think about a little bit while we're working on these kinds of things. So there it is. It's thinking about that soil, thinking about what makes plants work, what makes them happy. And if you think about plants. Plants create their own environment that they love to live in. And that environment is about, it's something that they create over a long period of time. And they've learned to take advantage of the decaying plant parts that are around them. Because that's what happens when plants move in, right? So actually, they benefit from that, but not directly. They benefit because they've encouraged a soil community of tens of thousands of different creatures, which includes, you can call them earthworms, but earthworms are just a small, teeny, tiny part of it. It's things like fungi, that is mushrooms. They play a huge role. The fungus do. Fungi are hugely beneficial in soil. It's the best kind of soil you can get. Comes from fungus decomposing plant parts in the soil. It makes the best soil possible. Bacteria are hugely important. They're incredibly important in breaking things down. Protists, amoebas, and things like that are incredibly important. Nematodes are incredibly important. Some of them are parasitic. They hurt your plants. Some of them are beneficial in that they both eat the nematodes that eat your plants, and also they also break down organic matter and also break down bacteria and other things into things that plants can use. So all these things are going on inside your soil. It's really amazing what happens in living soil, except we have to feed those creatures. We have to feed those creatures. And the way we feed them is by adding something you call organic matter. We call organic matter, but organic matter is just basically the dead parts of living things. It's just, I don't know how else to say it. It's just the decomposition, the dead parts, the leftover parts of things that were once living. That's organic matter. That's what makes organic matter, and that's what makes it so good. Grasses, leaves, all of those things breaking down in your soil. Hey, we're going to be back. We're going to talk a little bit more about it. David doesn't think I have enough of an attention span, but we've got enough attention span. We're coming back for another hour.
And waving black hair with the rose.